Good morning, everyone.
Well, I'm happy to be back in this AVI Germany. It's been some years that I haven't come here, but I'm always in contact with what's happening with AVI at Oroville or outside, and especially in Germany. And this time, not only am I happy to be back, but when I was asked to speak on management by consciousness, I had to think quite a lot, because I'm basically a student of philosophy and based in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. I had to really think deep and see what can be this management by consciousness. And then you see, I have the advantage of having stayed in the ashram from 1958, and the mother was there till 1973, so for about 15 years, I saw her management. Because if I think of management by consciousness, then she was for me the perfect example of how to do any management involving one's own consciousness, and that too a spiritual consciousness. So then it struck me, in fact, just last week, and then I wrote down what could be the principles of management by consciousness as seen and exemplified by the mother. So here I put down my thoughts, and I'm told those of you who do not understand completely English, there will be a session by Friederike and she will give you the main ideas later. I'm not a management expert, but I grew up under an expert of management. She was the mother of Sri Aurobindo Ashram. She had not studied in any management schools or attended seminars on management principles. But for 47 years, she managed a growing institution, the Sri Aurobindo Ashram, and in later years, Oroville, giving to each inmate not only an opportunity to express his swabhava, his inner nature, but also to develop his integral consciousness, his inner being, his soul. Her quadruple principles of managing the most diverse conglomeration of human beings, both at the ashram and Oroville, were wisdom, power, harmony, and perfection. And these principles were all wrapped in a divine love, and not in a shroud of the fear of the board of management or the boss. I suppose these form the essential principles of management by consciousness. Wisdom. The central principle of action of such a management by consciousness was, to quote Sri Aurobindo, all can be done if the God touch is there. We always felt confident of ourselves in work, in play, in life, because we had the immense faith in this dictum given by Sri Aurobindo. In a different manner, Sri Krishna had hinted at the same principles, though from a different angle. I quote from the Gita, Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna, Yatra Partho Dhanurdhara, Tatra Sri Vijayo Bhuti Dhruva Nitir Matir Mama. It means, wherever there is Sri Krishna, the master of yoga and Arjuna, the wielder of the bow, there shall be found wealth, victory, general welfare, and unwavering justice and ethical sense. When the human effort, here represented by that of Arjuna, is supported or sustained by the wisdom of a total vision and a spiritual consciousness, here represented by Sri Krishna, then there can be not only a well-being of individual, but also the welfare of the community and the nation. But modern man has alienated himself from the ancient truth of Nara Narayana, of the combined action of man and God to manifest God in life. Modern civilization grew out of the 18th century Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment. It gained universal approbation in the late 18th century through the movement of French Revolution and came to its own in the Industrial Revolution and the industrial socialism of the 20th century. It promised to emancipate humanity from the natural and religious limits. But instead of liberating humanity, modern civilization has brought humanity to the edge of self-destruction. We now face the slow threat of ecological poisoning. This is a quote. We now face the slow threat of ecological poisoning and the rapid threat of nuclear holocaust. In the meantime, great energies of human exploitation, oppression and alienation are unleashed across the worlds. The modern dream has turned full circle. Seeking to free itself, modern scientific progress has become precariously uprooted from the earth, from human community and its tradition, and above all, from the religious mystery. But luckily for us, we were outside this ring of modernity's self-destruction. We were at all times wrapped in the divine mystery. The Mother showed us closely and constantly that it is the divine who is there behind all expressions of life, be it political, cultural, religious, economic, or social expressions. In fact, as we grew up, life itself was slowly unraveling the hidden secrets of a divine presence. And to that presence, we progressively surrendered, ready at all times for her will and wisdom to guide us in matters small and big. You see, to give you an example of how we were taught to surrender, as a child, sometimes if I had to go to Chennai, we had to write to the mother seeking her permission and also telling her in detail what is the purpose of my going, etc. Well, she would graciously give a permission, writing on the letter blessings, etc. And then that was a small thing. Maybe once in a while we wanted to do some shopping there. But even a larger decision, like when I wanted to go to the USA for my higher education, after completing the ashram education, I wrote to her if I could go. In fact, I had taken my own decision of going. I even wrote to the university in the USA that I would be coming. But after sending the application to the university in the USA, I wrote to the mother saying, "Mother, I have written it this way, but the choice and the final decision is yours." And then you see, this was a very important stage of my life. And then she wrote back immediately telling me that if you want success and comfort, you can go to America and try your best. But if you want to belong to the new consciousness that is coming, you stay here and prepare yourself. You see, I had written at the end of my letter, Mother, in 10 days my birthday is coming, when I come to see you, so you may give me your decision on that day. But Pat came the answer on the same day I had written the letter, and she wrote a note in the end saying, I want your answer on your birthday. So it was a completely different thing. So I'm giving you this example. You see, for the modern youngsters and some of you, it may seem, what is there, couldn't you decide for yourself? We are free to decide for our own destiny. But we in the ashram had learned this process of surrender right from our childhood. And you see, after all, yoga begins with surrender and ends with surrender to the divine. So for us it was not a teaching, it was more a process of growth and living. And then, so we were given this training, and I suppose that one of the foundations of her working with human beings, this is what, if you want to call it a management principle, the foundation of her working with the human beings was self-offering and conscious surrender to the divine consciousness. Because surrender is the only security of life and the sure strength of all action. And most often her guidance, her replies to our queries would come as a happy surprise, telling our minds that it cannot plan and execute as it wants. That there is a higher consciousness, which when surrendered to, guides cutting across all logic and rhythm of human mind. She acted as a central authority of the ashram's management, but not as a CEO, blind with the power of professionalism. Her authority was centered in her having a far superior spiritual consciousness, which could regard all with equality and equanimity, keeping in view the totality of work and the needs of managing the ashram and Auroville at all levels, ranging from the supraphysical to the physical. She was generous, sweet, loving, understanding, forgiving, and at times strict, where there was hypocrisy and insincerity and falsehood. With her deep and equal respect for both man and material objects, we came to learn of a new vision of the equation between spirit and matter. We came to understand that matter is the body and form of the spirit. Because of this profound equation that came to be a living truth of our life, we knew that our own body is verily the temple of God. If that were a truth on the individual level, then it should be so on the collective level too. The human society is also an embodiment of the collective or the group soul. Further, nature and the whole earth itself is an embodiment of the spirit, a physical extension of the divine. All is a single whole, one divine consciousness. Power. This changed worldview, a recovery of the Vedic vision, definitely determined our way of thinking, feeling and acting. In the earlier centuries, religion had made the power of God more powerful than the divine love. This belief in an omnipotent and intolerant God had reflected in the ruthless attitudes of the human managers who dealt inhumanly with their workers and employees. The tendency to believe that God is only transcendental and not immanent ultimately led to the stage of thinking that there is no God. And atheism seemed to be the best solution, for the atheistic would be more humane and rational and less despotic. But it was not to be. Bereft of belief in the divine, man succumbed more to his violent ego, became immoral, and its relations with his colleagues and subordinates suffered more disastrous consequences. But having been given the Unitarian vision of existence, We learnt in our relationships with others to be non-coercive and more collaborative. In fact, even those who were in charge of some of the departments of the ashram were discouraged from dominating or imposing their views upon their co-workers. All tried to carry out with the utmost sincerity the work that was given to him or her by the mother. Each tried to follow her dictum without ever doubting her decisions, wisdom, or questioning her attitude. Each tried his or her best way to follow what the mother would want in a particular situation. Nothing else mattered. No other principles of management were applicable. Personal feelings, differences of opinion were all drowned in the wave of harmony that originated from her consciousness. Those who were not able to be receptive to the command of the higher consciousness or who opposed her wish and will inwardly revolted but suffered for sure disharmony and despair in their own individual self. Perhaps the mother was slowly establishing an ideal institution with exemplary management principles, while the world in general languished in dualistic and materialistic worldviews. Convinced by dualism, that is, human beings by virtue of their superiority in creation were totally different from all other creatures of the world, and this superiority gave man the unholy right to exploit nature and to utilize her for his fancies and comforts and pleasures. This anthropocentric and its consequent materialistic view resulted in an increased tendency to treat nature in a different manner. As against these anthropocentric tendencies that were swallowing up almost every human being and society and institution, the mother built an aura of austerity and self-contentment in the ashram. The sadhaks were getting trained to live a simple life devoid of all fancies and vital excitements. A sadhak was not to give vent to his vital desires, but on the contrary to control and check the wild runaway horses of desire. As regards the question of regarding others as mere objects or to look down upon women, such a notion did not exist even in the ken of our thinking. The divine is equally in all, and thereby all were to be treated equally. As the Upanishadic Rishi said, "I love my wife not because she is my wife, but because she is a soul." So we were trained to view it all as forms and figures of one divine consciousness. In fact, women are supposed to have greater openness to spirituality, we were told by the mother. So we had not only a co-education, but even in our physical education activities, no discrimination was made between girls and boys. I suppose the mother established this gender equality long before the Western world woke up to its women's liberation movements. Harmony. Not only was harmony being established between the in-charges of departments and the co-workers, between men and women, but the mother pioneered what has come to be known today as the ecological view of existence. She had experienced, even when she was a child, a close communication between herself and nature. Birds and animals endeared themselves to her, and she could even communicate with them. That is how she established the inner contact with the realm of flowers and named thousands of flowers after their inner vibration and aspiration. Such a communion with flowers and fauna gave us a sense of a consciousness of interdependence of the each species and each individual in the world. The deep ancient vision of Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, that means the whole humanity is one family, had become a reality of daily existence for us. Such a living in oneness with our surroundings saved us from the ecological crisis, which is one of the main topics of management studies these days. That is why we are surprised when the critics write that postmodern thought is ecological through and through and provides the philosophical and theological grounding for the lasting insights popularized by the ecology movement. If it, in fact, becomes the basis for the new paradigm of our culture, future generations of citizens will grow up with an ecological consciousness in which the value of all things is respected and the interconnectedness of all things is recognized. The awareness that we must walk gently through the world, using only what we need, preserving the ecological balance for our neighbors and future generations will be common sense. To feel the divine consciousness permeate each animate and inanimate object, to experience the divine sweetness in the sap of life, is the very essence of spirituality. An awakening to such a sense, only one with a divine consciousness can impart to others. If the mother could bring in us such a touch of the divine sweetness and grace and beauty into our daily life, obviously for her management was not a science or an art to be learned. She took the ashram sadhaks not as workers and wage earners, but as living souls with whom she could communicate and whose needs for growth could be addressed at all levels. As the organizational leader, she set a high example of aesthetics, work discipline, interpersonal relations, positive attitude, and a never-waning aspiration for a change and transformation of lower nature into a higher one. In fact, we were told by sadhaks who had come to the ashram as children that mother constantly used to tell them that the only value in life is to realize your own psychic being, your inner being. I mean, she would reiterate it in so many different circumstances. That was right from early 1930s and 40s. So today those who have grown up under her, this is the only ring in their ears when the mother said, always try your best to realize your own being. So for the mother it was not the profit and loss that was the chart of management's progress. For her it was the growth of consciousness of an individual that superseded all other considerations. You see, here I remember once a sadhak wrote to the mother that, mother, there's so much of money that is being wasted in the ashram and people do not realize because they're getting it free. Then the mother replied saying that, do you know how much of consciousness I put into them, and it is that they are wasting, and so that is much more important. Of course, money and financial management was important in the affairs of the running of the ashram. For her, money was not meant to make money. Money is a divine force meant to bring in wealth and integral health and prosperity to all human beings, irrespective of religion, nationality or creed. Money is at present in the anti-divine forces, but by the impersonal and desireless use, it can be brought back to the divine's work upon earth. So the mother dealt with money with detachment, not favoring anyone, but giving to each what was required. See, there was again a question I remember when somebody wanted a loan from the ashram. Mother said, the money doesn't belong to me, it belongs to the ashram. And ashram does not lend money to anyone. So there's always this, you see, she was completely the in charge, and yet she said, it doesn't belong to me. In fact, later years, one of the trustee members of the ashram, he told the mother, why don't you have a room for yourself? You see, for long many years, until 1962, mother did not have her own personal room. In fact, in earlier days, she was sleeping on a bench like that, the bench on which we sit and eat here. She had just a bench to lie down. She would come late in the evening after the work, and she had only a resting place where it was a bench. It's only in 1961, 62, when she became really unwell, that a proposal went saying, mother, you should have a room for yourself. Then she said, no, I cannot spend ashram's money on my room. So I cannot have that room. Then the ashram trustee raised donations particularly meant for the mother's room. So she never ever touched the ashram money, although she was the supreme person who could do anything. So you see, this is how she really completely left it with a detachment, not favoring anyone, including herself. She kept a high standard of the upkeep of material things, ashram buildings, cars, furniture, etc. Because matter itself is to be respected, cared for. Material objects have a sensitivity of their own, and they respond to our touch of love and care. Well, here she gave a beautiful example of the furniture at Golconda. Most of you have seen Golconda and the furniture in there. In fact, long many years back, I happened to be there for a fortnight, and the first rule that is given to us is, do not change the position of the furniture, except for the chair, which you can drag closer and push it back. No other change, even a 1 inch, you should not be moved. So the table is there for the last 55 years, the bed is there for the last 55 years, they have not been changed an inch here or there. Because that is how she said, the way we use furniture is, you know, we have no respect. We sit on that, we throw it out, and then we discard it. But you can see now how beautiful is the furniture at Golconda. It is as if the wood itself is speaking to us. Because this is the care and respect, she said, we should have to all things of materials. And to that extent, we have seen ashramites, you know, maintaining their cycles, their vehicles, with such perfect order. Not that we do not do that here, but there is a consciousness that it is the mother's vehicle. The mother has given me this cycle. The mother has given me this motorcycle. So this consciousness of, you know, not only we see spirit in matter, but for us personally it belonged to the mother. And everything that belonged to the mother had to be taken care of. So you see, this is the practical sense we had. So we are not speaking of high spirituality, but for us spirituality was interchanged with the consciousness of the mother. So that is how we all respected furniture, materials. And in fact, these material things, they were not supposed to be used and thrown, just as the employed workers were not just to be hired and fired. The ancient Indian tradition of Ayudha Puja was the daily attitude for her. Ayudha Puja, maybe you don't know, annually we have a day of puja ceremony, when we really clean every little object. A carpenter would really clean up his screwdriver and whatever little things, saw and all that. The driver would take up all these mechanical tools. If I have a car, I take it out. You see, that day it is not just a cleaning. Cleaning we do throughout the week. But that is the day when all the material objects are worshipped. They put garlands and flowers, and there is a special mantra that is read. And it's a kind of an absolute ceremony that is being held. So that is the reverence that in Indian culture we have had right from ancient times. Of course, that is based on a story in Mahabharata. That's not important. There's always a story behind. But what is important was that each object that you use, you are in contact with, you have to respect. In fact, even the pen and the pencil and the eraser and the computer on your table, each has its place. Mother's famous dictum that was there that really guided my life a lot is Shakshos Asaplas. Paska Shakshos Asumplas. You see, this is the philosophy. Each thing in its place, because each thing has its proper place. So it's not just we throw the pen one day here and another day somewhere else. Because even the object likes its place. It comes to be, you know, getting used to that. So that object wants to be there. So this simple thing that she told us, Shakshos Asaplas, so you can come to my room, my house, any day, any time. And this is one principle I have followed of material objects, to respect them and to keep them Asaplas. And that has given us a different dimension in our own living. That is, when the mother says beauty in the physical life, is not just necessarily to have gorgeous things and flower vases and expensive flowers. It could be beauty of simplicity. And beauty comes when you have this Shakshos Asaplas. So these are small things, but you know, I'm not really turning them to management principles, because in management also we need to have a proper care of the objects and all that. But here, the attitude changes. It is a thing not because it's expensive. Even a pencil has to be taken care of, although it hardly has any value money-wise. So the whole attitude to material things was changed. So the mother instilled in us true feelings for objects, especially those which we use in our daily life. So we had to be careful not only in their usage, but in wasting them. Today, if the world economy is melting, it's because we have much wasted and disrespected matter. It is gross commercialism that has given us false values of matter. We use it promiscuously. This mistake has to be righted, and only then the economic meltdown can be corrected for good. In fact, here I remember, when I speak about the question of wastage, that in those days, the mother, when she used her soap, there was Champaklal, who was her assistant. You know, when the soap bit becomes very tiny, you can hardly hold it and rub it on your body. I think these days you don't know what a soap means. You have all the liquid soap, you press the button and you have the liquid soap. But when we had the soap cakes, in India we still use a lot of the soap cakes. When it becomes so tiny you can hardly use it, normally we throw it away or we keep it somewhere and it vanishes. But Champaklalji was told to put all those pieces together, 5, 7, 10 soap cases, soap cakes, and then that small pieces would make another soap, and the mother would reuse that until the end. So when somebody asked her, mother, you have so many soaps, you know, mother used to get her soaps from France and Italy, and all those who came from abroad always presented the mother with some soaps and perfumes and this and that. Not that she wanted, but they thought she's a French woman, so she liked to the French things. But then she said, mother, why are you really taking care of such soap pieces when you have so many in plenty? Mother said, if I don't start economy with myself, how will the world economy run? So you see, the economy begins with oneself, not just thinking about big principles and big budgeting and big interest rates and all that. And also I was surprised, and I'm almost, I must say, stunned, when you come to Pondicherry next time, see a place called Sri Smriti. And that's, if I can be very frank, one of my complaints with the organizers of AVI International. I think you should bring all your youngsters, Friederike, and I'm telling all of you, to ashram. Show them that aspect. Because there is Sri Smriti, an exhibition of the mother's own personal things right opposite the playground. And there you see, this is what I'm talking about, mother's care for things. I mean, imagine in 1914 she came to the ashram, and in 1920 when she returned from Japan, she brought lots of things from Japan. I mean, she was such a great lover of art and beauty. She had letter pads, and she had umbrellas, she had dresses. But from 1920 she kept them so well that the letterpads think, they seem that they are brought out only yesterday. So absolute care, it's not that she didn't want to use them, but you see with what care she kept them for decades and decades. She never threw it out. So this is, and there's another thing that we saw in the exhibition is the handkerchief. It was stitched so many times. I mean, there were holes that torn here and there. Mother got it stitched. And you know, for her to get a piece of cloth like that, it was not difficult. But then she said, no. This still has a value. It is as if the handkerchief would speak to the mother and say, please use me more. I want to be of service to you. And in fact, in Japan, when she was living there, she had a small vegetable garden. So when she went into the garden, she said, if the vegetables would speak to her and say, Mother, pick me up. I want to be used today. So in fact, the flowers and the vegetables would tell the mother that I want to be of service. So even so, the small little tiny handkerchiefs, these tiny soaps. So this only reveals, you know, as children, when we come to know these principles, so automatically they sink into your consciousness. And then we may fail in our attempts, but it doesn't matter. Failure is not important. But what's important is we begin to know the value of things. So these we were told, we saw, and we grew up in that. So we really saw that what the mother did was this Ayudha Puja. Ayudha is the instruments, the weapons actually. So the weapons have become another word for instruments. So daily oblation was to take care of every object. Everything wiped. Every little thing wiped before you use. You know, we come on the computer, start with a press button and start getting the internet. But we were taught, no, you must clean it up. And even the photographs in the house. How often do we clean the photographs in our house? Not our photographs, mothers and Shivabindas. They are there and they are there. When the darshan day comes, maybe some of us wake up and say, we must wipe the photographs today. But she said, no. You see, every object has a living vibration. And then she said, the more you respect, the more it wants to serve you. You see, that's the other response. It's not just you are doing it out of selfish motive that it will last long. No. You see, sometimes a car, she said, if you really care for it, you know, the accidents, you know, the question of, you know, sometimes getting into trouble and problems, it avoids because it's conscious that its master is there riding it. So there are so many things that we have learned about this. Can I have tea? So it was a kind of a living experience, the way she managed human beings and materials. She, and then we said, now to the last section, perfection. Now behind all these attitudes towards matter and money and management principles, there was one central motive, perfection of man. All circumstances of life, all material comforts and discomforts, all events, sad or joyous, were there for the growth of human consciousness. If only one could be conscious of these ups and downs as in sadhana, then the progress towards one's perfection would be faster and smoother. It is true that perfect perfection is a phrase that Sri Aurobindo uses only once. Perfect perfection. It's true that perfect perfection is obtained only on the supramental level, where matter is fully conscious and transformed. One could always attempt for a progressive perfection here. For perfection is a state of harmony. It increases in dimension and depth as our consciousness enlarges. So to achieve harmony and beauty between not only human beings, but also between man and materials used or produced, was the daily consciousness that was given to us. On the level of action or karmic work, the mother has given many suggestions as to the true attitude to work. One of them is the freedom to choose. Now, this is one thing that I learned myself when I was a student. You see, she always gave the choice, the freedom to choose. But as I said, you know, even in that letter where I was wanting to go to American University, she didn't say, don't go. She didn't say, go. She gave two alternatives. If you want success and comfort, go to America and try your best. That's one alternative. The other one, if you want to participate in the new world or the consciousness, you stay here. So the choice was given to me. It was not imposed upon us. So that is the wisdom that we always had. She gave us the two opportunities or two angles. And that is in fact the principle of our education also. She said always give the child the different possibilities. Then let the child choose. But it's the duty of the teacher or the master or the parent to tell the child what are the possible results, consequences of your action and decision. And then the decision is the child's. So here also we saw that she always said, you have the right to choose. But once chosen, you have no right to be indisciplined. You see, for example, when I was a student, some of us did not like some particular subjects. Somebody said, Mother, I don't like geography. Somebody didn't want to do mathematics. Somebody did not want to do history. So we wrote to the mother. Mother would say, take your time. But if you choose, then once you enter the classroom, until the end of the year, you have to be completely following the discipline that is given by the teacher. There you cannot say, no, I don't like the teacher, I don't want to go. No way. So this was the fundamental thing about her, even in life. We have all the choices. But if you take to a particular choice, you have to follow that path. That is sadhana. There if you come up with your fancies and then you say, no, I have my freedom of speech and freedom of expression and freedom of thinking. Well, actually, she would say freedom is there given to grow spiritually. That's the true freedom. To express one's own vital desires and fancies and all that, that is not freedom, that is license. So she always drew the difference between license and freedom, and she told us as children that if you want to grow spiritually, you are free. But otherwise, to say, no, you see, I'm an individual, I have the freedom, I'm a modern girl, I'm a modern man, I don't believe in all that thing, that is giving vent and expression to your own lower nature. And that, she said, is again to us, is up to us. If you want to remain on the lower nature, with the vital and the mental and the limitations and the desires, it's up to us. But if you choose to be a sadhak, if you want to lead a spiritual life, there are some principles. So one of them was this freedom of choice, and we have seen this many, many times in all circumstances. So one was the freedom of choice, and another one is consecration and self-offering. This, of course, I've dealt with before. But these are two important principles which could be applied to management or self-management or spiritual management. That is, you know, once we choose to be in the ashram or to follow the mother's principles, then we try our best. I do not say we are all sadhaks. Well, there are some great sadhaks in the ashram, but obviously many have failed. But failure, as I said, is not important. To walk on the path, that is what is important. People may fall 10 times, may wake, get up again 11 times, keep walking. So she said, surrender to the divine. And then this is another question. Some of you may have questions in your mind, especially the young ones here, that why should I surrender? After all, I am an individual. I have my individuality, I have my capabilities, I have my possibilities, I have my weaknesses. So Mother is not telling us to surrender only your weaknesses. Because you know, surrender and all this question of self-offering are only a means to grow. We don't understand that. We think surrendering is self-abnegation. It is not self-abnegation. It is a means to grow out of your weakness, to increase your own potential, to increase your own capacity. And if that is the meaning of surrender, why shouldn't I do that? After all, I'm doing all these courses and classes and this and that, only to increase my capacity, only to increase my self-expression. If the mother says, I'm here to help you, you just raise your hand and I hold it, it's like, you know, we have the famous saying, the island joins the continent. Who gains? The island, when it joins the continent, you see the whole flood of the continent coming into the island. The consciousness, the power, the sweetness, the beauty. So the mother was that continent of spirituality, and we were this island egos. So we said, that is what is the meaning of surrender. So she said, do not hesitate, because I am not there to take away your freedom, but I'll give you the true freedom, the inner freedom. So this was the second choice. But perhaps the one that is most useful suggestion, at least it's been for me personally, is one that Sri Aurobindo wrote. Always behave as if the mother were looking at you, for indeed she is looking at you. This has helped me in managing my own life immensely. Because you know, some people may not believe in it. Some people may question if the mother is really looking at you, if the mother is really omnipresent. But friend, this is something that cannot be, you know, explained or expressed. It is something that you need to experience. Once you have that faith in your heart and your mind is convinced that the mother is omnipresent, then that works miracles. But if your mind comes to doubt, say, no, mother is only in Pondicherry, no, she is a physical being. She is not a physical being. She is a consciousness. And that's what she told one of the sadhaks when she left her body, that if ever I leave my body, my consciousness will be with all of you to work, whatever you are working on. So we take her more as a consciousness. The physical mother, we keep her photographs here and there, is more a kind of a reminder of that omnipresent and omnipotent consciousness. So this is what has helped me immensely, because it is not the punitive attitude of the ancient God. That's very important to understand, that God is looking at you to punish you, to see what you are doing good or wrong, bad, the sin and all that. It is not a sin. It's just watching over you, with which the divine consciousness looks at us, nor of the boss overlooking your shoulders. It's more a consciousness that guides us through, takes us nearer to our souls with each step in life. There is here a sense of intimacy of the divine, for it is an intimacy with the divine that we can grow best spiritually. This is again what we have lived through, that oneness with the mother, and that is how, you know, when I said in the beginning that she helped us to grow in our own souls and inner being, the first principle was to have this intimacy. You see, in our management, why is it that we are not able to open up ourselves to the board of management? Because we have fear. But here with the divine principle, it was the principle of love and intimacy. And those of you who have read the Bhagavad Gita, you are conversant with the Gita, that is the central principle of the Gita. That Arjuna and Krishna were friends. They were not even disciples. Because it's only two friends who are most intimate. So when we look upon God or the divine as something superior, as a kind of a disciple, then the intimacy doesn't come in. So in the mother, what we have learned is not to look upon this kind of a discipleship and a mastership. We were asked to be children of the mother. Because apart from friends, the other combination of intimacy is the mother-child. So that is what the mother-child relationship is with us, the way you can be intimate with the mother. And Gita, we have the intimacy of friends. So that's why Arjuna could ask any question to Shri Krishna, and Shri Krishna answered all his questions. There's never a question of saying, hey Arjuna, what, why are you asking this question? And it's always this intimacy. In fact, Arjuna, those who have read the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna tells, where Sri Krishna shows his universal form, he says, oh Lord Krishna, I did not know that you are such a, you are the Lord. I thought you are my friend. So sometimes I abused you, sometimes I gave you slang words and all that. But please do not mind. So that, and Sri Krishna says, because of that intimacy that you have developed with me, you are my most favorite son, child, disciple and instrument. So if you want to be instruments of divine's work, more than being a disciple, be a child and have this intimacy. That's why mother always encouraged this kind of a communication with the mother. So as a child, you know, after 1962, we could not see the mother on a daily basis. From 58 to 60, yes, we saw her every day at the balcony darshan. Every morning we should see her. She would come down. We should see her when she again started arranging the flowers over Nirodhvaran's room. You see, even this little thing, she herself came down to arrange the vases. And don't tell me anyone here is more busy than the mother, what she used to do. But do we have time to arrange our vases? Even one vase we don't arrange because we just buy from the bazaar, put it down. But I've seen with my own eyes there used to be a dozen vases on the windowsill, and she would take flowers in each vase, arrange them properly with color, pattern, whatever. A particular consciousness. She gave time for that. So you see, what I want to impress upon you is, I have seen the mother managing and are expressing with her own divine consciousness every little thing. Because this is what we saw, there's nothing small or big in divine's eyes. Shobhindu wrote somewhere, there's nothing small or big in God's eyes. So he says, being a butler or a king is equal in God's eyes. So that is the equanimity we experienced. So for us, philosophy, management is not a principle. Has been a kind of a real living. That's why I do not say I'm a great sadhak or anything, but when I think of the mother, all these things come back to my mind, to my being. I mean, there's something that vibrates in my whole body cells because it's been almost a body experience. So here, I can see now, this is the intimacy that the mother gave us. And the mother gave this sense of intimacy in great indulgence. And we profited by this to the extent we were open to her in our inner being. If the psychic is open within, then we could get all the guidance needed both in the inner and outer journey of life. And the last conclusion, to wrap up. It is with her loving ministry of the ashram and Auroville that the mother established the integral principles of management on a small scale as well as a big one. That is to say, if the most important element of management is man, then the mother gave us a new vision of man, his weakness and his capabilities, and his awaited destiny. And when I speak about the weakness and his capabilities, again I remember when she asked us to surrender our weaknesses, she said, surrender not only your weaknesses but your strength also. You see, sometimes when we went to the mother for darshan or on our birthdays or on a specific interview, especially on the birthdays, I remember, I mean, we used to be so-called well-dressed as we normally did. Well-dressed is not fancy, but at least, you know, an iron shirt and an iron trousers. Well, in my childhood, I don't think I even had trousers. We had only shorts. So we used to have clean dress at least, and went with a bouquet of flowers to her. And, you know, in the beginning there's all the aspiration that you're going to the mother, you're sitting there and you're really aspiring and all that. But when you're waiting upon her, because there are people in front before you, so, you know, they're taking time, and so 10 minutes becomes 20, 20 minutes becomes half an hour, then as the time goes by, your aspiration also wanes. You can see the drooping of the flowers, and you are getting to be drowsy, and some people even snored. But then Champaklalji suddenly would say, "Anand, next come up." So when he called us up, we went up the steps and went into the mother's room. And mother often, I mean, this is all recorded, it's not my telling you, you can see it in her own writings. She would say, some people came and, you know, all well dressed and with a great aspiration, "Mother, I want to be this, I want to give you my offering." But then she said, they would never give their weaknesses. They would always show, as we go to the temple and the church, showing our best face to the divine. But she said, often I used to see behind their head all their weaknesses popping up and saying, "Hey mother, I'm here." You see, we suppress our bad points, our bad thoughts, our bad feelings. You see, we'll say, no, when we go into the mother, we should not think of desires and lust and sex and this and that. I should think only of the divine and aspiration and rejection and surrender. But then she said, don't do that. Because even if you don't give, I see all your weaknesses at your back. The only thing is, consciously give it to me. Then that's a better thing. Instead of she having to grab it from you, she would say, give up both your weaknesses and your strength. Because after this giving up, she would then cleanse us, give us the necessary strength. And the most marvelous moment I always remember, even till today, it's been how many years now? 36 years. You see, when we went to her, the first thing was, she caught us, caught our eyes with her eyes. That was the looking into, and that's the most memorable moment we had with the mother. And I tell you, friends, when she looked into your eyes, you did not exist. The world did not exist. I mean, that was a strange feeling. Even after 36 years, if I look at the mother's eyes, I have the same feeling. That we lose the world. I mean, that I doesn't exist. Neither the body, nor the mind, nor the feeling, nor the world around. I mean, that was the... I mean, it's not a magnet. It's much beyond the divine look, as we say. And then when she looked into you, I mean, we are sitting like that. I mean, she would really capture you and wipe you off. I can use the word, yeah. Wipe your existence off. And then we did not know where we were, who we were. And it was an eternity of time. It could be 10 seconds or 1 minute or 30 seconds. But for us, time also didn't exist. When space doesn't exist, time doesn't exist. So we were there. And when she pierced, because that's what she said later on, explained, that then she pierced into our soul, and that is when she asked the soul what it wanted. So if this is what we call, really, for me, that's the spiritual management. When she asked the soul, what is it that you want? Otherwise, mentally, vitally, I may want a lot of things from the mother. But have you ever seen, what does my soul want? Maybe we don't even know. We are so much bothered with our external wantings. But mother first asked the soul. And then she would pull herself back. And that too with a very sweet nod. I still remember. She would blush into a smile. And then a quiet little nod to say, "Come out." So we were kind of, you know, in a daze. And we came out of that daze. And then we came up. So at that time, we could give her flowers, not the flowers, any photograph, ask her any questions, take a book. Normally, I used to take a book from the mother on my birthday. That was a privilege. On that day, you could ask the mother for anything. So the first book she gave me was Prayers and Meditations. Right in front of me, she wrote to Ananda with blessings. Later on, every year, I used to take Life Divine, Synthesis, Savitri and all that. So that was the time when you could, when you knew you were with the mother, you could talk to her. But then again, when we did the pranam, when we bowed down our head on our feet, second time again we lost our mind, our hearts, our being. I didn't even know that I was touching the mother's feet. She had socks, white socks on her feet. And then we would lie down there for long and long and long. And again, I tell you, because I've told this many times in my classes also, that what Vivekananda had experienced with Sri Ramakrishna. When Vivekananda wanted for himself a job, because he was very poor, he had no money at home, nothing to eat even. So he told Sri Ramakrishna, I want food, I want shelter, I want clothes. Sri Ramakrishna said, go and ask the mother. And he went into the temple of the mother, and there, when he saw the mother, he forgot to ask. He comes out of the temple and he says, Sri Ramakrishna said, have you asked the mother? Hey, Babu. Then she said, no, I forgot. He says, go back. So thrice he goes into the temple and thrice he forgets. Because there he says, give me understanding, give me knowledge, give me love, give me grace. Nothing of the material. At that time I didn't believe. But when I went to the mother, I experienced myself. That no material possessions, no material gains, no name, fame, comfort, nothing comes. And what comes also you don't know. So, this is the experience with which we have lived and we are living. I mean, there are so many controversies, there are so many things that come in our life. But one thing that has hooked us to our feet is those darshans. I mean, those pranams. And those pranams are still, you know, and then when the pranam would be, when we are dead on our feet, she would bend down, touch on our head very lightly, telling us, you get up. And so, when we felt that touch of our mother's soft, very beautiful soft hands on our head, we would get up. And then she would give us the bouquet of flowers. She had roses on her left side and different flowers on both sides. She would select the flower, give it. And then the last thing is, when we left the mother, we got up, and I don't know how many of you have seen the mother's room, but when she is there, the exit entrance door is at the back. So when we went, you know, it's very peculiar. I still don't understand why. But she would always follow us right to the gate, to the exit door. I mean, follow us with the turning her neck. It was not necessary. But she would always see that you are really as if to say bye-bye till the last moment. And then when we left the room, the other person would come in. So this is, I mean, what... I don't think there's any word called management that is can be applied here. It was purely consciousness, a divine consciousness itself, which groomed us. I don't know for how many lives we can benefit this presence and this touch. And I'm sure it's not just for this life that she has blessed us with this touch and divine. Because I do feel that once you become the child of the mother, give up all other priorities and really go deep into that soul, then I feel you're blessed for lives together. As we believe in India, in rebirth, I know that I'll come back. My soul will come back in a new body, with a new name, in a new country, with a new place. But this thing is for sure, that her blessings, the contact that we have had this life, will continue for lives together. That much I am confident. Well, this is the last thing I would like to conclude. She brought us back the synthetic view of matter and spirit, emphasizing upon the truth that matter too can respond and reveal the spirit. We can delve deeper into it with deep love and respect. She established in a living manner and not didactically the quadruple principles of wisdom, power, harmony and perfection, which in fact are the principles of a spiritual self-management, both on the individual and collective levels. With this living inspiration and guidance of the Mother's ministry, if I can manage my own life and manage to go a little deeper towards my own inner being, then I would consider that I live my life meaningfully. That, I suppose, is the goal of management by consciousness, to make each person manage his or her life in the light of his highest consciousness. It is said that a drop of practice is better than an ocean of theories. So all the theories of management would be meaningless and all the seminars on the principles of management redundant if we do not take a plunge into our soul and let it govern and manage all the parts of our being. For the soul within each one of us is the true manager, the true governor of our life. For Sri Aurobindo says, "For man intellectually developed, mighty in scientific knowledge and mastery of gross and subtle nature, using the elements as his servants and the world as his footstool, but undeveloped in heart and spirit, becomes only an inferior kind of asura, using the powers of a demigod to satisfy the nature of an animal." So let us recognize the divine manager within us, and then there would be no need of any outer principles of management. It would be spontaneous harmonizing with each being and without, amongst each community, the ideal of all management by consciousness. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. That was very touching, very touching.